Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A hot summer in Afghanistan is getting hotter. Coalition forces now weeks into a big push in the country's south, the heart of Taliban and poppy country, taking casualties, roadside bombs and attacks all over. July 2009 is already the deadliest month for U.S. troops in the nearly eight-year-long war. Taliban fighters, bombers, suicide bombers are striking back hard on multiple fronts. Here are British troops who have also taken significant losses fighting Tuesday in Helmand province, the center of the new surge. The fighting is village by village into straight-up enemy turf. The strategy is to clear, hold, and build. How well it will work remains to be seen. This hour on Point, the new push in Afghanistan. You can join the conversation. What are you hearing from the troops, the front lines in Afghanistan? Will this work? Clear, hold, and build. You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here from a mountainside near Kunar, near the Pakistan border, U.S. troops used heavy artillery just last week to hit enemy fighters. Check, check, fire, and the war goes on hotter than in a long time in Afghanistan. We have a number of great reporters standing by for this hour, but the phone lines to Afghanistan are unpredictable, so bear with us. Joining me first from Kabul, Afghanistan, is Laura King, reporter for the Los Angeles Times. She's been most recently in the country's eastern section near the Pakistan border, but she's covered the whole country. Laura, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Laura, if you could, first to U.S. casualties. 31 at this point in July, that's the highest in almost 8 years. What's driving the casualty numbers for the U.S. and other coalition members this month?
Yes, for both U.S. and coalition members, for American troops singly and for the coalition as a whole, it's been a deadly month here in Afghanistan. Part of it is, of course, due to the major offensives going on in the south, but the east also has been a persistent trouble spot, and the casualty count there just has been rising every day or every few days. Just the other day we had four killed in one IED in the south, in the east. So various parts of the country are trouble spots.
And just yesterday, the pushback here, suicide bombers going at several Afghan and American installations there in the more northeastern area of the country. What happened?
Well, a wave of attackers attacked a number of government installations and an American base almost simultaneously, you know, suggesting a real degree of coordination among them, and that might be a hallmark of a network that operates in eastern Afghanistan, the Haqqani network. But it also seems tied to the fact that the elections are coming up in just a few weeks on August 20th, and that there might be an effort to foster a sense of insecurity in advance of that. That might be the Taliban's goal, to make people feel unsafe.
Laura, is a whole new American or coalition strategy evident to you? You've been covering this. Is it obvious that we're doing something different now? And do people think that it's showing signs of promise, or is it still a question mark?
Well, I think it's still a question mark to a great degree. But one important thing that has taken place since General Stanley McChrystal arrived about a month ago is that he made very clear that coalition troops, not just American, but all coalition troops, must really exercise the greatest degree of caution possible in safeguarding the lives of Afghan civilians, because this had become a really contentious issue between the Afghan government and the Western forces, that simply so many civilians were dying in the course of engagements between Western troops and the Taliban that the Afghans really felt it had become unacceptable. And McChrystal seemed to react very, very quickly to that.
There's been a big buildup in American troop levels there, and it's not over. Where are we in that American troop surge, Laura?
Well, it's still continuing. It will go on through the summer and into the fall. There are supposed to be 68,000 American troops here by the end of the year, and that number might even increase. There has been talk about an additional increase on top of that.
The talk very recently was, from many people, that the coalition was losing the war. Is it clear if that's been turned around, or is this just an effort for a pause, as you say, of security for the August 20th elections when President Karzai stands for re-election?
Well, I think the reason that the U.S. had a very unusual change of command at this point, bringing in General McChrystal, was a sense that the war is not going well, and I think that is shared by NATO allies as well. I think that there is a belief in senior military circles that it still can be turned around, but definitely there is an acknowledgement that things just have not been going as well as hoped.
And what about the word from Islamabad in Pakistan today, reported in the New York Times anyway, that Pakistani officials are complaining that the American effort in Afghanistan is driving the Taliban back across the border. Their military doesn't have the strength to deal with it. Do you see American commanders responding at all to that? Are they likely to pause at all in response to Pakistan's plea to let up?
I don't think so. I think they will go ahead with their activities on this side of the border. And also, what American officials are saying is that they don't see really any outflow of Taliban fighters from Afghanistan back into Pakistan. So this might have just been kind of a preemptive thing on the part of Pakistani authorities, or it might have been an effort to they might have made this comment for domestic political reasons, you know, to say, oh, we're trying to rein in the Americans.
But disconcerting to have a so-called ally, even the checkered kind of ally like Pakistan, with that message right now. Laura King with the LA Times in Kabul, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us now from Kabul, Afghanistan, Pamela Constable, reporter for The Washington Post. She's just back from Lashkargah, the capital of Helmand Province, which is the focus of the big American military push in the south. Pam Constable, it's been a long time. Thank you very much for joining us.
Well, it's a pleasure, Tom.
What did you see in the south, Pam? We're reading reports that the resistance has not been that strong, that the U.S. Marines have been able to push forward without a heavy Taliban pushback. Was that your experience?
Well, yes. I talked to a number of American and British as well as Afghan officials while I was down there, and they said that things were going extremely well in military terms, and that they had been able to go into a number of districts and clear them of the insurgents rather quickly. But what they said was that they were worried that this was going to leave a void or a gap in civilian authority. They were going to try and help fill, because of course the people are afraid that the Taliban will come right back, especially if there's nothing there to replace them.
Well, what about that? The new strategy is summarized as clear, hold, and build. Does that look promising? Do you see it happening so far? Is it too soon to say?
I think it's too soon to say. I know that everybody's aware of the need to build, and I think that the Americans and the British certainly have some pretty solid plans in place. But what they say is that unless they're able to get the Afghan capacity to be better and faster and more effective, unless they can get governors and mayors and judges and people who can settle disputes and people that can give aid into these places so that people have a more confidence in their own governments, especially in the area of things like justice. I mean, the Taliban are famous for quickly and dramatically settling disputes, where the Afghan government is famous for dragging its feet and never settling disputes. So there's a great deal of concern that the Afghan side of things is really not ready to build soon enough.
Pam, Helmand in the south has been the center not only of Taliban activity, but of poppy growing and the drug trade out of Afghanistan. Did you see coalition forces, American troops, going after that, the poppy trade, the poppy fields?
Well, actually, no. What's happening is that there's been a pretty strong switch in policy. They basically decided that the old methods of crop eradication, rather poppy crop eradication, and the replacement or the attempt to replace them by inducing farmers to grow legal crops has not gone very well. And so now what the Western forces are starting to do, or say they're going to do, is to refocus on more law enforcement measures, getting tough with traffickers, cracking down at higher levels. but that's a lot easier said than done, because these people have been around for a long time. Many people know who they are, and they're very, very hard to touch.
Pam, did you get a chance to talk with any of the Marines, the troops there, about how they feel digging into not just clear but hold? They're going to be staying in a lot of these population centers.
Well, as Marines tend to be, they were pretty gung-ho. I mean, it's still a very new mission. I mean, it's only a few weeks old, and as we said earlier, they've had a lot of success in their own right. They've got a brand new civilian component in there to back them up, which is a very new kind of concept that they're trying out here. So the sense I got from talking with Marines that were briefing us and briefing other officials was that they're all in a very sort of upbeat mood for the time being. I mean, there's still a few pretty dicey districts they haven't gone into, but the main focus, I think, in the coming weeks, as in the rest of the country, is going to be securing the elections. It's very important for elections not only in places like Kabul, but also in conflict places, that people be able to vote as much as possible. So there's going to be a lot of focus in these coming weeks between now and August 20th on not so much building, but clearing and holding areas so that the elections can be held, so that both the Afghan and the international forces who are there can protect voters in the districts that have been cleared. In fact, they got special dispensation to register voters in those recently liberated districts long after the deadline.
Pam Constable with the Washington Post, thank you so much. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the big American coalition push in Afghanistan, the Taliban's push back, and now Pakistan saying from across the border, enough. It has been very difficult at times getting in, fighting, and bringing in air support without civilian casualties on the ground. The battle, of course, was raging even before this recent surge. Here's sound from the end of June when U.S. Marines were in a firefight with the Taliban at a smoldering compound of buildings. They ended up calling in that airstrike.
Get that gun up, Clark!
Yeah.
Turn it up north!
That's the real deal, as real as it can be. One of the chief dilemmas, of course, is how to use that air power without killing civilians. There have been a lot of mistakes. Here's a clip released by the U.S. military about 7 weeks ago, the cockpit pilot trying to shoot enemy fighters who are near a civilian area.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 guys. Two guys running down the wadi. Third fire.
Two guys running down the wadi. Sound there from very real fighting in Afghanistan with all of its dilemmas. Thanks to Laura King of the LA Times and Pamela Constable of the Washington Post for joining us from Afghanistan. We're joined right now by two very well-informed observers of what's going on there. With me from Monterey, California, is Caleb Sepp, Professor of Defense Analysis at the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey. Former Special Forces Officer, retired Army Lieutenant Colonel. Caleb Sepp, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks, Tom. Good to be here.
And with us from Hardin, Montana, Gretchen Peters, veteran journalist, has covered the region for more than a decade for the AP and ABC News. She's author of the recent book, Seeds of Terror, How Heroin is Bankrolling the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. Gretchen Peters, thank you very much for joining us.
Hello, Tom. Glad to be here.
Caleb Sepp, first to you. How do you see the offensive going? Is this war being turned around? Is that too much to ask? It's a big country, bigger than Iraq. Can we do it with the force levels that Barack Obama is pouring into Afghanistan?
Well, the real point is exactly as you say, that how big Afghanistan is. You know, geographically, it's bigger than Iraq. The population is larger than Iraq. Could we put over 150,000 troops into Afghanistan the way we did in Iraq? The answer is simply no. It can't go in that direction. The answer is something that many of the officers who are in Afghanistan right now are advocating to General McChrystal as he is working through his 60-day assessment, which is that the solution to this is not more foreign troops, it's more Afghan troops.
Bring it.
And that would be more police in particular.
more Afghan troops, let them carry it, but more American troops are pouring in there right now. Khalif Sepp, stand by. Gretchen Peters, the clear, hold, and build is the sort of little triplet that we've been given to understand the strategy now. You're watching. This is right in the heart of poppy country. You know it very well. What do you think of the strategy? Can it work?
Well, I absolutely think that the solution to Afghanistan is going to be law enforcement, rule of law, and therefore, yes, they have to clear, hold, and build. They have, in recent years, or since the invasion of Afghanistan in 2001, the sort of joke among State Department officials and others is that annually our military goes down and mows the lawn. They cut down the poppy fields and then they leave again. And so there's never been the holding and building aspect of that is critical to any counterinsurgency strategy. As Mr. Seft pointed out, there has to be local partners, reliable local partners, to go to assist with that holding and building part of it. But again, another problem with Afghanistan when we compare it to Iraq is that Afghanistan has about a third the number of local security forces, police and the military. And while the Afghan National Army has been trained up by the United States over the last 7 years, the Afghan National Police is in relatively dire straits, a very, very corrupt force, also involved in the drugs trade very deeply. And one of the things the Marines are finding as they push into the Helmand River Valley is the villagers are saying, we welcome the Taliban back because the Afghan National Police were so corrupt, so violent, abducting their children, involved in the drugs trade. And believe me, the Taliban down there are hardly a lovable bunch. I mean, they have really imposed a horrible reign of terror in southern Afghanistan in the districts that they now control in Helmand and Kandahar and neighboring Nimroz province.
Everybody's talking big there. We've got a little tape here from a Taliban spokesman a little over a week ago talking with Al Jazeera, the Middle Eastern television network, and talking tough in the face of the U.S. Marines' Helmand offensive.
We have been successful. The enemy has been suffering heavy casualties. It is a guerrilla war, and those are our tactics. We will resist them in Helmand, and we will attack them all over Afghanistan.
The Taliban spokesman there saying, you know, we have been successful. Pushback from the coalition. The British have taken heavy losses this month. A lot of controversy in the UK about that. Here's British Prime Minister Gordon Brown last week in Parliament making the case for continuing the fight.
If we are to defeat this vicious insurgency and by doing so make Britain and the world a safer place, then we must persist with our operations in Afghanistan. I am confident that we are right to be in Afghanistan, that we have the strongest possible plan, and we have the resources needed to do the job.
The British Prime Minister saying he's confident. Khalif Sepp, what should we be aiming for here? You've cautioned that using the word win, winning this war, may be the wrong construct, but it's, you know, for ordinary folks, it's hard to understand other options. What do you see on that front?
No, Tom, you've asked exactly the right question about, what should our strategic objectives in Afghanistan be? And using terms like winning, you know, that evoke images like the Marines planting the American flag on top of Mount Suribachi, you know, and wiping out the enemy, this isn't going to happen there. We're not going to be able to send in, you know, more Marines and, you know, more paratroopers and somehow defeat the Taliban in the field. They're masters of avoiding conflict when they want to. When they stand and fight, they fight very, very hard. But they're also very good at manipulating the information, like the piece that you just played, you know, that, far exaggerates their successes. But they're talking to a particular audience.
Right.
That wants to hear this sort of thing.
But here's my confusion, Khalif. The Obama administration has talked about or given signals of sort of dialing back ambitions, being more realistic, maybe in line with what you're saying. On the other hand, clear, hold, and build sounds very, very ambitious, almost like, you know, nation building village by village.
Well, this is tough. It is what's going to have to be done long term. And one of the things that Laura King and Pamela Constable were bringing up in these operations that are ongoing right now is they were talking about elections. But what we can't do is confuse the conduct of elections with the establishment of real governance. And you know, one of the terrible ailments that Afghanistan suffers from, and I'm sure Gretchen Peters is familiar with this, is that over the years there's just been a drain of real human capital, the kind of Afghans that, you know, have the education and the willingness to be the technocrats, the bureaucrats that actually run government, aren't there. So we've got a much bigger piece than just pushing the Taliban out of the villages and the rural areas. We've got to rebuild the government to be able to serve the people in the way that will build a loyalty to the government and keep the Taliban out.
Gretchen Peters, this is now a very long war. It, of course, will be 8 years this fall. That makes it the second longest war in American history. Only Vietnam was longer. Everybody talks about wanting to be realistic at this point. Do you hear realism emerging in the coalition American plans?
I hear realism emerging, but I don't. I agree completely that the real challenge here is going to be building a government, or helping to support the development of a government in Afghanistan that can actually govern its people. And to me, the bigger challenge even is what's going to happen on the other side of the border. You mentioned that the Pakistanis are now complaining that all we're doing is pushing the insurgents over the border into Pakistan, a country that is unraveling, I think, at a very alarming rate. To me, the biggest challenge that we face there is not just the fact that the insurgents and other extremist groups are making hundreds of millions of dollars off of the drug trade and other criminal activity and really becoming more ruthless and more violent in their behavior. The real challenge is where are we going to find reliable partners, either in the Afghan or Pakistani government? And it's absolutely true that there has been this brain drain, really, in both countries. People are leaving the region who have the capacity to run. The bureaucrats, the technocrats, are fleeing because there have been massive assassination campaigns, particularly in the border areas. A lot of the tribal leaders, a lot of the educated people have been killed, and their families are simply pulling out. I know, you know, have quite a few friends who've left the region permanently because they say it's just not worth it any longer. This creates a vacuum, and I don't know how. To me, the big challenge is how are we going to fill that vacuum, because obviously we've already been there, as you said, for almost 8 years now. Nobody wants to stay forever, and the only exit strategy is building. We're not going to defeat the Taliban and al-Qaeda by trying to shoot them all. I think that was the misguided military policy before. I think now there is an understanding that we will win, if we want to use that word. We will be able to leave Afghanistan and Pakistan once they become irrelevant. And it's going to be very, very difficult to create a government in both of those countries, or to help foster the environment where a good governance will grow.
Yeah, pretty clearly.
Very, very difficult challenge.
Gretchen Peters, Khalif Sepp, I want to turn to our listeners, if I may. From Columbus, Georgia, Tommy. Tommy, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I served in the military, and I did a tour in Iraq in 2003. I was part of the 3rd Infantry Division, 3rd Brigade here at Fort Benning over on Kelly Hill. And in fact, I was a sniper in the military. And we first took Khalil Airfield in southern Iraq and moved all the way up into eventually setting up an AO in Baghdad.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a. I want to talk in particular about the suicide bombers. We had an incident at a pediatrics hospital that we were tasked to protect. And upon arriving there at the end of one day, we had a crowd of children, an unusually large crowd of children that had gathered, and they began pointing at an individual, and it was an Iraqi male. He was wearing blue jeans and just an ordinary shirt. He just completely blended in with the crowd, and it come to be that some of the children said that he had a grenade in his pocket, and he did. Sure enough, we looked and saw the bulge in his front right pocket, and we were able to sequester him off to the side and remove the grenade from him, and in fact was a live grenade, and he had come there.
At a children's hospital. Mm-hmm.
He'd come there to attack us in particular, not just the children's hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And my point is that it seems, when they say win this war, the role of a sniper basically is to be completely unseen. The only person who should know the sniper is there is the sniper himself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really kind of the same approach. In fact, it is the same approach that a suicide bomber, the advantage that he has is that the bomber is willing to strap 20, 30, or 40 pounds of explosives to his body or her body and walk into a crowd of people and detonate an explosive like that, that seems like an extremely difficult opponent that you can actually claim that we're going to win against. I mean, how do you beat a suicide bomber who's willing to do that? I'd, even having been there and experienced those things myself, I sit back and I wonder, how is it possible to actually win against such an opponent?
It is the question. And Tommy, thanks for your service and thank you for your call. Khalif Sepp, how about it? There's the question. Tommy was a sniper in Iraq. He knows exactly what he's talking about. And we've seen more and more of this in Afghanistan as well. Just yesterday, big sort of waves of suicide bombers coming at fixed facilities in Afghanistan. In Iraq, it appears to have been turned around to some extent. Are there parallels that can be drawn here or not, Khalif Sepp?
There are, and this extends, of course, actually beyond the region. I mean, you know, suicide bombers are you know, apparently are involved in the bombings in Jakarta. They've mm-hmm. been you know, suicide bombings occur regularly in Israel and Palestine. So as a particular tactic for attack, it's widely used when one of the agents feels that it's going to be appropriate, it's going to get them to their objective. Our casualties right now, 2/3 of our casualties come from the improvised explosive devices. You know, these roadside bombs.
Yeah.
But the suicide bombs are particularly insidious. The way that this is suppressed is it actually goes back to what Gretchen Peters had mentioned before about. You know, as an extension of a law enforcement issue, these in the same way that the listener described how the children themselves spotted this bomber, the population knows a lot about what's going on, and if you have good intelligence networks established in the local population, you can discover many of these plots and these plans. And they can be rooted out. This can't be done with foreign troops. They're just never going to have that kind of interconnectivity, on a long-term basis with the local population. In Afghanistan, it's going to have to be done by the Afghans. The Pakistanis are coming to grips with the problem themselves right now.
But the foreign troops are us.
That is us.
And we can't do it. Gretchen says she sees problems with the reliability of Afghan forces. I don't want to be too broad with that, but there's famous problems with corruption here and maybe divided loyalties. And our caller, Tommy, you know, reminds us people can kind of melt away, come back when the coast is clear. That handoff to the Afghans, is it showing promise to you right now, Khalif Sepp?
I understand fully the complaint about the police corruption. This has been well and widely widely known. But we've in our own way, the coalition has contributed to this by complaining about it and then not doing very much about it. But the police are salvageable. There's some very positive signs. If they were wholly corrupt, then you have to ask why did there in most of the provinces, why did they have three times the casualty rate of the Afghan army? Even in the south, they suffer the same number of casualties as the Afghan army troops do. And there's real potential there. And in the cases where they have had adequate advising, they've actually done very well. And even with all these complaints outside of the worst areas where the Taliban operate, the police have a 70 to 80% approval rating among the population.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the big American push in Afghanistan underway right now, and the Taliban's push back. NATO's been taking a fair amount of criticism for its performance in Afghanistan, and of course the casualties there have been raising eyebrows. In London yesterday, outgoing NATO Secretary General Yaptehup Scheffern spoke about the need to stay in Afghanistan.
The window for public support in Afghanistan, by the way, and in the troop-contributing nations, is not unlimited. My opinion is that we'll have to stay there for the foreseeable future. If you ask me what is then exactly the foreseeable future, I cannot answer. But I'm not going to think in time frames and in window frames of a year or 1.5 years.
The window is not unlimited, he says, but the challenge seems to be just about unlimited in his little summary there. Joining us this hour from Hardin, Montana, Gretchen Peters, a journalist, veteran journalist, long experience in the Afghanistan-Pakistan region, author of Seeds of Terror, looking at how heroin is behind a lot of Taliban and al-Qaeda activity. And with us from Monterey, California, Khalif Sepp. He's a professor of defense analysis at the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, former Special Forces officer, retired Army Lieutenant Colonel. Got a lot of listeners who want to join this conversation. Let's go to Omaha, Nebraska, and Tony. Tony, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom. How are you?
Okay, what do you see?
Yes, sir. Thanks for taking my call. I believe that being a former military personnel myself, you know, we're not necessarily perceived as being liberators at this point anymore, nor have we ever been. I believe that you know, it's a much more systemic problem going on there, that we need the actual collective effort of the government itself and the people of Pakistan as well as Afghanistan to become actively involved in alleviating and taking care of this issue themselves internally. I don't think we are able to do it ourselves from a military standpoint. Going to require a much more greater effort on the part of the people themselves and the government.
Yeah, Tony, I'm sure that U.S. troops and coalition forces there would say amen to that. Of course, the challenge is getting it. Thank you for calling. Let's go to Waverly, Iowa, and David. David, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
The strategy clear, hold, and build is simply a rewarming of the same kind of basic military strategy that we have advanced for years and years and years, which is based upon superior firepower and superior numbers. It will not work in Afghanistan for three reasons. Number one, there will be no transfer of authority to Afghan police. It is a tribal society, possibly the most tribal in the world. The Soviets found that out. You cannot find a central government in that country, and you will not. Number two, geographically, it's prohibitive. It is a mountainous region. Everything is local. They don't care about a central government. And number three, this is a guerrilla war, as they all have been. Firepower and superior numbers do not win guerrilla wars. Getting the locals on your side is the way you win guerrilla wars, and clear, hold, and build is the most dangerous and civilian casualty-oriented option. A better strategy is supply and defend. But our military, we're still fighting the Civil War.
David, do you speak with military experience?
I was a captain.
In the Army?
Yes.
Let us put it to our former Lieutenant Colonel, Khalif Sepp. You hear the critique, Colonel Sepp. What do you say?
Well, I think that he's right on a number of points. That the geography, the geography of Afghanistan is just daunting. The Marine units now that are deploying to Iraq train in the High Sierras in order to get some sense for the ruggedness and the altitudes that they have to operate at. It is a tribal society that does have a sense of district government, though. Professor Tom Johnson has often written about this, and there is less connectivity to the central government, but there are viable forms of local government that are affected, and tribes aren't an anti-government force. They're their own kind of government. I don't know that he has a grasp of what clear, hold, and build actually means. But once again, he's right that firepower isn't going to solve this for us. But General Stan McChrystal, in what he is already beginning to enforce, is bringing back that firepower, restraining it, and combat operations can be conducted with much more calibrated, much more graduated use of force. And as soon as that's that as soon as that's imposed on the American military units that are operating, they respond, and they are responding.
Gresham,
so it's not quite as impossible as I think that he might assume.
Gretchen Peters, the geography is clearly very daunting, imposing. But what about culturally? You hear the distinctions Khalaf Sepp is drawing between national and regional sort of coherence. Culturally, do you see, even if it does have strong tribal substructure, could this hang together and resist the Taliban after some kind of American coalition encouragement, or is that just not in the cards?
Well, I often hear the argument from analysts and historians and people who have looked throughout history that the people of Afghanistan and Pakistan, particularly the Pashtun tribes that live along the borders between those two countries, are wild, ferocious, ungovernable. But my experience in researching in that area and traveling in those areas is that the one thing I hear over and over again in every village that I went to, I was assisted in writing my book by five local researchers, and the one thing we heard over and over again was that people wanted security, better governance, schools, health clinics, the same thing that people want in our communities. I don't really think they are ungovernable. I just think nobody has really tried to help them put their communities together in a more organized fashion. And so I agree completely what Mr. Sepp is saying about implementing what I would call a bottom-up strategy, starting at the community level as our troops move out into these rural areas. And what is actually, they don't call it the surge in Afghanistan, they call it an augmentation, because they don't want to indicate that we're not going to stay around. These troops are going to be there, I think, for the foreseeable future, and I do believe it will be a very, very tough slog for American and other NATO allies who are out there. And one of the critical elements of this project is going to be retraining the local forces. Some of them do have tremendous capacity or potential for capacity, but the programs to train and retrain, re-equip the Afghan National Police, and in particular pay them decent salaries, have so far been a bit of a mishmash. And I think that there now is increased focus by the new command, Lieutenant General Stanley McChrystal and the Pentagon really understand that they have to... That our government needs to help support the rebuilding of these community-level security providers that can really be partners to our troops there. I do think it's possible. It is going to take some time, but I do believe that it is our best exit strategy for the region. Every time a terrorist attack takes place around the world, it comes from those border areas. Increasingly, it's planned and carried out on the Pakistan side in the tribal areas. That's going to be, in my opinion, an even bigger challenge, stabilizing those areas than stabilizing southern Afghanistan. But really, the same formula works. It is building better governance, extending the rule of law. And I do believe the people of those regions want that.
And not with a surge, you say, but with an augmentation, the word being used to indicate something permanent. Dick is calling from Boston. Dick, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'd like to call your attention to a New York Times article I read just in June. It stated that President Karzai pardoned four or five convicted drug dealers who were then serving 14, 16, 18 years in prison for dealing in heroin. They were, the article pointed out, pardoned because they were from wealthy families and he wanted to tap their families for money for his re-election campaign. Now, how will you ever get good governments from the Afghanis when the president is corrupt? I have a solution. That is, we will not spend $60 billion a year to support our U.S. troops and Marines in that country. We bribe the Taliban, who are, after all, native to the country, like the VC were. The Al-Qaeda folks are from Central... I understand they're from, like, Central Asia and North Africa, and they're not Afghan natives at all. And we bribe the warlords. We tell them, you keep out the Al-Qaeda folks and sort it out yourself.
So buy the peace. Don't fight the peace. Let me take the corruption or the heroin piece first there. Gretchen, this is kind of in your wheelhouse. Hamid Karzai is up for re-election August 20th. I think there are 40 opponents in that election contest for the presidency of Afghanistan. I read recently where there have been a number of Karzai rallies, but he's appeared at none of them. What about at the very top? Our caller Dick says corrupt from the top. Is he right?
Well, there are all sorts of questions about members of the Karzai administration and even members of his own family. It's widely believed that his brother, Ahmed Wali Karzai, is one of the main facilitators of the drug trade in Afghanistan. Both the president, Hamid Karzai, and his brother have denied this, of course, and challenged the international community to come up with the evidence. But I personally was shown Western intelligence documents that detailed his involvement, Ahmed Wali Karzai's involvement in the drug trade, as well as the caller mentioned this very disturbing pardon that President Karzai made of four or five convicted drug traffickers who were related to political cronies. He's also chosen as a running mate Marshal Fahim, a former warlord who has connections to, has allegations of smuggling have swirled around Marshal Fahim for years. So, again, I do believe that that's a very, very serious challenge, and I think the way around it is to start from the bottom up, start at the community level, and people will push criminals and bad actors out of their communities. One of the issues I think that has to go on to me that's critical is a reshaped public relations strategy in Afghanistan, and that is to talk about these allegations, to investigate them publicly. I think there has been very little effort by the international community, the United Nations, the U.S. government, to actually look into these allegations to try and prove them, whether they're true or false, and then go to the Afghan government and the Afghan people and say, look, this man is involved in the heroin trade. You need to fire him. You need to put him in jail. And if you're not willing to do it, we'll take him and extradite him to the United States. We have extradited, the DEA has extradited about 7 narco traffickers from Afghanistan. They've all been connected to the Taliban. There's been very, very little effort to go after corrupt officials within the Afghan government and Afghan police. And to me, that is a major challenge. Mm.
Let me go to another call on this drug front. Mark in Niagara Falls, New York. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi. Good day. this would be for Gretchen, I guess. I believe I was given to understand that poppies are one of the most drought-resistant crops in the world, and given the amount of water that they have to work with and the irrigation technology, that's about the only thing they can grow. Am I wrong?
Well, Afghanistan has only been a drug-producing nation since 1979 when the Soviets invaded. Prior to that, it was a food-exporting nation. In fact, Helmand province, where the Marines are pushing into, was actually the breadbasket of Afghanistan, produced melons and grapes and wheat and some of the most incredible roses that I've ever seen in my life. There's no reason, in my mind, that Afghanistan can't be a food-exporting nation again. One of the things you constantly hear from Afghans as you go into these villages is that they need their irrigation fields, their irrigation ditches fixed. And that I've seen this as Marines, I've seen wire reports coming out of Helmand in the last few weeks of Marines pushing into a new village, and the villagers say, look, we don't trust you guys, but if you come in here, you provide security, you help us fix our irrigation ditches and build a school, you might get us on your side. And I think we need to respond to these very simple requests that they have. People are growing poppy because years of war and bombardments and lack of basic development and infrastructure work have left them with few other options than growing poppy. Another side of this, of course, is the financial side. The Taliban and the traffickers, the drug trafficking organizations, send in merchants who pre-purchase the crops in the fall. That gives poor farmers the money they need to get through the winter.
Mm-hmm.
The microcredit programs run by aid groups, we don't need to run them. The military doesn't need to run them. There are aid groups that do this kind of work. Why aren't we going in and offering to buy melons in the fall?
Buy melons, grow roses. Khalif Sepp, I want to bring to you Dick's comment earlier, our caller Dick saying, look, we're spending billions to fight a war. Why don't we just use the money, bribe the Taliban, buy them out, buy a piece, buy the warlords? Is that possible?
This is exactly what's been proposed by Professor Andrew Bacevich right there at Boston University.
Yes.
as one of the possible solutions. This has been done before in various conflicts in various parts of the world. I wouldn't use the term bribe. You know, it's just a subsidy that you pay if they do what you want them to do, which is to, you know, to suppress the Taliban and to keep Al-Qaeda out of their towns and out of their districts and out of their provinces. It's a way. It's not the. It may not be as Professor Bacevich says. A perfect solution, but it is certainly something that has to be considered.
New York Times columnist Tom Friedman has been out in Afghanistan for the last week, and he's writing just today. You may have seen it. He says, "Look, my heart says about this whole thing, mission critical. My head says," he writes, "mission impossible." Where do you come down, Khalifsev?
We have to go back to what we started this conversation mm-hmm. with, which is what's going to be the United States and NATO's objective in Afghanistan? We can set, as and we have set in the past, impossible goals that could not be achieved. My thought is that the new administration is much more pragmatic and much more realistic, and will understand what can be done in Afghanistan, and will adjust our objectives accordingly.
Let us hope for that. I'm very grateful to each of you. Khalifsev in Monterey, California, at the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
And Gretchen Peters joining us today from Hardin, Montana, author of Seeds of Terror, How Heroin is Bankrolling the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. Gretchen, thank you for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be here.
Listeners, thanks for being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.